You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
Welcome to today's episode. Today I'm joined by Angelina Jaspers, who has an incredible and interesting background in the world of marketing and brand, having worked for some really interesting brands, including Kodak when it was in its heyday. We'll talk a bit about that. Worked through a major merger in the IT space in the early 2000s, the HP and Compaq merger. And then we're going to be dealing and digging into a big rebrand story with a major B2B global brand, probably that most people have never heard of. But I think the point here is that a lot of brand stories, a lot of rebrand happen with these major B2B brands that many of us never heard of. So Angelina, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Gabriel, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's dig straight into your background, because the Kodak story is a fascinating one. And I think that's really where you cut your teeth.
Yeah, and very absolutely. So right out of college, I cut my teeth, even before college, because I worked 3 summers and 2 Christmases at Kodak, believe it or not, in the typing pool, because I was a pretty fast typist at the time, and then was able to be hired after I got my 4-year degree. But anyway, cut my teeth at Kodak, which at that time was a Fortune 20 brand, was the 4th most admired brand in the world. They had 90% market share in film. They had 80% market share in cameras. And they were a company that they were a household name and a company that everyone knew and everybody loved and admired and respected. It was a wonderful indoctrination into the marketing field. And I say that because everyone that I worked with on the marketing team, in the brand team, communications team, were trained, they were seasoned. And there was such a rigor and a discipline involved that was unparalleled that I had some of that discipline instilled as well when I joined HP years later. But really, Kodak was where I cut my teeth. I spent some time in the B2C side, but most of it was on the B2B side, because little known at the time that half of the revenue of the company came in from Kodak through its B2B product offerings, but not as much of its profit, obviously.
You know, what are some of those aspects? You talk about sort of the discipline and the training that you had at Kodak that have stayed with you your whole career, that you think have always been critically important, and that maybe today don't get as much attention, to its detriment.
Well, one thing in particular, which I found, the two sides of the coin, one you could find troublesome and the other side you could find enlightening, was the agency brief, the agency briefing process. There was actually a document that said how you do an agency briefing, what are the key things, the form that you had to fill out before you could release any money or assign any project to an agency. And it was reviewed either by the CCO, the chief communications officer, or the chief marketing officer. And it asked all the basic questions that marketing and branding professionals should know and should have thought through before they even approach their agency. Who's the audience? What's the objective? How will you know if results are achieved? What's the budget parameter? What are any watchouts? All those key things that are so, so, so important. And you had to fill out that creative brief and have it approved. And then they would assign you, money at that time was centrally held budget, they would assign you the funds in order to implement that project. Or they would guide you and say, you need to ask this, or you need to include more background information on X, Y, and Z. Today and later on, so many times in agency, I was on the agency side for about a year, very briefly, I hated it. And because we would get phone calls after hours, someone would call, leave a voice message and say, hey, Angelina, I need 4 boilerplates or 4 tech sheets for XYZ project. And I need it by tomorrow at 5. Can you whip those up for me? And it's like, okay, this is a tactic in search of a strategy. Do we really need a data sheet? Do we really need a video script? What do we need Let's get to the heart of what it is we're trying to do and what we're trying to serve before you just bark out, I need these five tactics and I need them right away. So that was the discipline that I learned. One of the things they had a wonderful, it was just so many good learnings. Of course, it was a company that for all its great learnings and the fact they actually had a marketing education center that they would send their marketing and salespeople to learn and train. They wanted everything to be done in a very branded, customer experience oriented way. So
it's interesting. There was a study that was done last year that was called the Better Briefs Project. And in that, they asked about 500 marketers and about 500 agency people. And they asked the marketers how good they thought they were at writing briefs.
Oh, very good.
And then they asked the agencies how well they thought that marketers wrote briefs. And the discrepancy was huge. Something like 15% of agencies think that clients write good briefs, whereas clients think that about 70 to 80% of the clients think that they write good briefs. And it's interesting that a couple of decades on from your experience, how that gap is still big and how we've lost this focus on what is such a foundational process. And regardless of whether you're working with an agency or not, but just the discipline and importance of brief and understanding what you're trying to do internally, because oftentimes, even if you're doing the work internally as an organization, you need that brief internally to get internal alignment or with your for your internal teams.
Yeah, it could be seen as a pain in the neck, but in reality, it's a good internal discipline, the planning. It's strategic, right? It's making marketing more strategic. It's focusing on the outcomes versus the outputs. So often it's like all the tactics. And that's why marketing gets bad reputation many times, Gabriel, because it's known for that's where I go if I want a logo or a video or a data sheet, rather than I have a problem. I want to grow my business. I want to grow customer retention. Or those are much more interesting challenges to work on as a marketing and branding professional.
In your mind, what were always the most important components to have in a good brief?
So the objective, obviously, the audience insight is key, even if it's external audience insight, but internal research is important. But the insight, the objective, very, very clear objective without stifling what it is, the deliverable. An idea of the deliverables, but enough room there so that if an agency or a partner or an internal marketing organization comes back and says, I don't think you need a video. What I think you need is a series of six blog posts, that they have the creative freedom to come back and solve your problem based on your objectives very creatively with their tool of marketing tactics that they can apply to it. So I think those are the important pieces. Obviously, then the timeline and the budget is important too.
So after Kodak, you went through, like I said, one of the biggest mergers in IT history. A lot of people might be listening to this, might not remember or have ever heard of Compaq. But I remember at the time in the early mid-2000s, Compaq was big as, if you've heard of Dell today, you would have known who Compaq were at the time. What did you learn from that experience?
So that was a fascinating. After I left Kodak, I wanted to get away from Rochester, New York and the weather on the East Coast and sought my career ambitions on the West Coast, and HP was on the West Coast. And so I joined HP and I was there for 14 years. And people say, wow, 14 years at HP. But in 14 years, there were six different CEOs and six different CMOs that I worked with. And so it was a different company every 2 years or every 18 months. And one of those, so when I joined, the CEO at the time at HP was Lou Platt. I don't know if you remember Lou Platt, but he was one of the last of traditional HP engineering type founders. So HP has always been a company of inventors, of engineers, and the pocket protector type. And then a year and a half after I joined, they brought in Carly Fiorina. I don't know if you remember. Yeah, and this is 2000 probably. And she was brought in to shake up the image of HP from being a company of scientists and inventors to being more customer-focused, customer-facing, more exciting. And she certainly had a very charismatic, exciting persona about her. One of the first things she did, which was perceived as pretty controversial at the time, a lot of back and forth, was merge Compaq with HP. So as you said, it was a household name. Compaq was down in Houston, Texas, and HP, of course, was up in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, California. And it was positioned as a merger of equals. Well, we know how that goes. And so they merged these two huge companies together. And they actually did an excellent job with training in change management at the time, which I thought was, I really appreciated. They said, for instance, one exercise that I remember, they said, if you were HP, what kind of shoe would you be wearing? And then these are workshops. And the other thing they say is, if you were Compaq, what kind of a shoe would you be wearing? And so it was really very interesting to bring the two cultures together. Very different cultures. The Compaq culture was very much, we have a problem, let's all get in the conference room and solve it. HP's culture was very much thoughtful, planning, methodical. Let's write a brief about it, and then let's discuss it after we have that and come up with a better solution. So the culture clash was real. And I remember also at the time, I had a fairly large team in the Americas region, and they said that moving forward, because I inherited all these people, that we had to have 50% of the management team had to be Compaq employees, and 50% of the employees had to be Compaq employees. So they had very strict guidelines because they really wanted to merge, because the obvious tendency would be just have them underneath rather than living up to the promise of a merger of equals. Anyway, and so what we discovered very early on, though, is there was what I call title inflation. No disrespect intended, but a VP of marketing at Compaq was really at a very different level than a VP of marketing at HP. It was more aligned to like a director of marketing at HP because our titles were not as aggressive or inflated or whatever you want to call it. It was just a culture thing again. And so as we slated people into these teams, 6, 12, 18 months later, it became very apparent that some of the skill sets were quite the same. And there was some readjustments that needed to be made. But that integration or that merger had huge ripple effects and was a great learning experience.
What were the few things that you learned most from that experience that you sort of carried forward with you into the future that sort of always stuck with you?
Yeah. So what did I carry forward with me? To really make sure, well, one thing, because I talked about the title mismatch, to really make sure that you meet with each and every single person on the team rather than, I mean, when you're talking about thousands of people, it's hard to meet with everybody face to face. But to really do the hard work of meeting with people to understand, one, where they want to be, what their strengths are that you might not know. A job title doesn't tell you all someone's strengths, background, or experience set. It just tells you what their current role is, to really understand the total person. And because what that's what you're hiring, right? Not only their past and experience, but the capabilities and their aspirations moving forward. And to really put the right people in the right roles. And that's the right thing for the organization. And to be very clear, I love the one thing, I love the change management. I think that's probably where I learned a lot about change management. And they took a lot to do the culture change. HP did at the time. They had a team in HR and marketing that put together these programs to really meld the culture. So I took that with me, that any initiative, whether it's a brand, a rebrand, a merger and acquisition, divestiture, a lot of what that hinges on is change and change management and getting people on board. So I think that's one of the strongest attributes that a marketing and a branding professional needs today is the ability to persuade and get people aligned and marching in the same direction.
So before we move on, I want to double click into that quickly because we talk a lot about change management today. In fact, we hear a lot of client side brand leads and CMOs talk about how change management has become a really key skill. Any sort of stories or things that they did well as part of that change management process that you can sort of lift the hood under if you can remember it?
Yeah. Well, again, it was the workshops that they made you go through and then the guidelines from those workshops. I think that was the big thing. It was inclusive. It wasn't just a set of directives. They could have just said, this is the new world order and this is what you need to do moving forward. And nobody would have bought into the vision, but they really spent a lot of time having you understand the vision as well as understand the people and the culture. So I think that part, I think to get people on board, you need to have them buy into your vision. And the timeline involved, and the reason, the rationale behind why you're doing the change. So I think the getting people on board up close and personal. They touched everyone in a workshop, a personal workshop. I think that's the key takeaway that I learned from that.
So let's dig into the main part of today's episode, which is the Flextronics to Flex rebrand case studies. Set it up for us. Give us a background on Flextronics and your role at the time, and why was an organization in this category looking to go through a rebrand?
Sure. So after I left HP, they had what they called an early retirement package, that if you had the right length of years of service and, well, anyway, if you had the right combination of things, you could take this package, because they were during one of the downsizings. And so I took it, even though it was like early retirement. It is very early retirement. I wasn't ready to retire, but it was too lucrative of a package to pass up. So anyway, long story short, I was settling into a consultancy based and enjoying some free time. And then a year later, I get a call. Your famous past bosses are wonderful sources of future revenue, of future business for you. And it was one of the six CMOs that I had worked with at HP, not the last one, but one of the six. And he said, "Hey, I just joined this company called Flextronics." I said, "Flextronics? What are you talking about? Who are they?" "Oh, they're in the Bay Area. You don't know them?" I said, "No. Outsourced manufacturing company. We have this wonderful opportunity to rebrand this company and bring them into the new age." I said, "Wow, that sounds exciting." I always loved working. He was my favorite CMO. So I always loved working with Michael. So anyway, so he asked me to come in and rebrand the company. So I became a Flextronics employee. And they're an industrial manufacturing company, outsourced manufacturing company. To give you a little background on the company, they started in 1969. It was a family-owned business making circuit boards for Silicon Valley. And at that time, Silicon Valley was in need of circuit boards. And they grew since 69 to be this $26 billion company with 170,000 employees, over 100 facilities, over 30 countries. They're a big powerhouse, but no one had heard of them. And they were in my backyard. I had never heard of Flextronics.
$26 billion and 170,000?
Employees. Yeah, 170,000 employees, $26 billion. Yeah. And so it was intriguing, but it was also in the industrial space, outsourced manufacturing space, which I hadn't been as exposed to up till that time. I was B2C, B2B mostly. And so it was a new market for me. And it was a great challenge. I thought, yeah, to be on the forefront of rebranding this huge company from Flextronics to Flex was an honor and a privilege. And it's something I jumped into.
So talk a little bit more about outsourced manufacturing. What type of clients would they have?
So they were contract manufacturing. So they are the company that would produce the Apple iPhones. They are the company that would produce, what do I have, a Logitech, a video cam. They are the electronics company. So it's not trinkets and trash. It's not the unintelligent products. It's really products that have sensors and that have some intelligence to them. Again, their origins were in circuit boards. So it was more electronics manufacturing, but not only electronics, with scientific applications, aerospace applications, transportation, a number of applications, agriculture. So anything that needs intelligent manufacturing devices. And they would take your designs and then they would manufacture them. And of course, companies would lock in long-term contracts with these, with Flextronics. And they competed a lot at the time when I joined on price per unit almost. So it was almost like, how cheap can you make these widgets? And so our job was to really rebrand this company in a different age. And so we talked about the age of intelligence of things. IoT became a big, some of the core anchors of what we revolved the company around. And we found some interesting stories. So getting back to you, what kind of customers did they have? They had a very, I wouldn't say finite, but they had a very defined set of customers who they knew very well. They would lock into long-term contracts. So that's why they would divide it into automotive and aerospace and agriculture and transportation and all these other industrial products. But they were very much a behind-the-scenes kind of company. And that's why nobody had ever heard of them. The story behind this is they were approaching the 40-year anniversary. And the chairman of the board actually brought in a CMO. He said, "We need to shake this company up and take it into a more modern age and have then become more well-known and increase revenue and growth and all that. So they brought in my boss, the CMO, and then he hired me. I was one of his first hires as the VP of corporate marketing and global citizenship, because they had a great sustainability story to tell as well.
But just to play devil's advocate on this for a moment, if you've got a business where you've got customers locked into long-term contracts and where a lot of decision is based on what the price per unit is, what was marketing and brand walking into here? How could marketing or brand help? Because it feels like the role of brand and role of marketing is pretty low.
Yeah, and there were not a lot of seasoned marketing or branding professionals on staff. So as is very true for a lot of manufacturing and industrial companies, they don't see the value of brand, but it takes somebody at a board level or somebody from the outside or investor to highlight the fact that their share price, their profit, and their top line revenue could grow if they added a brand component. So there has to be a brand evangelist or a brand believer somewhere that says we could do more if we had a better story to tell. So that's basically what they brought Michael in, the first CMO the company had ever seen. And again, he started building out a team and we set to work. At that time, the CEO, Mike McNamara, wonderful guy, he said, everyone calls us Flex. They don't call us Flextronics. They call us Flex. So we pivoted on that and we rebranded the company from Flextronics to Flex. And we highlighted their applications, their stories, their customer stories, I think, were the important thing. And we rebranded them Sketch to Scale, Sketch to Scale Provider in the Age of Intelligence. And the Sketch to Scale, sure, the manufacturing, the producing of those millions and millions of widgets a day, very, very important. But it's what led up to that, which is the design capabilities, the prototyping, all those services that Flex also offered before it got to manufacturing. And then at the end, and that's the scale, Sketch to Scale, all those services that they offered after the manufacturing process, which is the sustainability, the end of life, all that stuff. And we packaged it as a set of solutions or offerings from Sketch to Scale. And then we highlighted some really innovative startup companies in the Bay Area and some other areas of the East Coast, West Coast, other parts of the world that had interesting stories to tell of how they would work with Flex to take their product to market and scale it. So it was really very great branding effort. That was, we're talking about 2015. So we're going back a dozen years, or 10 years, a decade almost. So we announced a new company name and a corporate identity that was aligned with the company's direction. The company had set the direction. The CEO said, we are Flex. We are more than just, we're no longer just a Tronics company. We are Sketch to Scale solutions provider in the age of intelligence. Those are the words we came up with.
And that meant moving away from just pennies on the widget, right? To be able to actually, that's where the opportunity to have more of a price premium, closer partnerships with customers and be chosen for other things just based on competing on the cost.
We wanted to appeal to, now don't forget the bread and butter and the way that the company was structured. This was one of the challenges, the way the company was structured out in the hundreds of facilities in 30 countries was they were rewarded for bringing in the manufacturing and being the most efficient and economical in that manufacturing process. So there was some kind of, I want to call, I guess it was skepticism, like, okay, you're talking about Sketch to Scale, but let's talk about the bread and butter of what's really driving this business. But sometimes I think the lesson we learned here, Gabe, is that sometimes to draw attention to your core business, you have to lead with those sizzling anecdotes on the fringes and those customer examples or those stories that are really intriguing that help you bring them in, a new set of customers in. And then you can tell them about your full capabilities. Because some industrial companies, while they do very well, some of their products are, it's bread and butter stuff that's not that exciting. And so it's marketing's role. There's a saying, you've heard of it, there's no boring products, there's just boring marketing and marketers, right? So our role is to make the product less boring and to make it more relevant by enticing, bringing them in, telling the story. And then, yes, driving revenue for the core bread and butter, but also our goal was to build up those other businesses as profitable P&L centers.
So talk about that internal buy-in then. So you come in, shaking everything up, gone through the rebrand, you're leading with more sizzling anecdotes and making things more interesting. How was all of this perceived internally? Who were the supporters and how did you start to feel a sense of momentum and to know that this was working?
Yeah, so it's a great question. It gets us back to what we started with, the change management, the change leadership piece. So I think an important piece was interviewing everyone on the executive team and getting their perspectives and getting them on board. And then when we came back with the first draft of things, interviewing them, getting their perspective, getting them on board. So it's easier just to deal with the CEO and the board chairman, who is very supportive of this. But it was so important to have all the line of business people involved. I think the biggest, I don't want to call it resistance, but the biggest skepticism, again, is a good word, were probably the people in the trenches, the leads of the manufacturing sites out there in the field. And anything that corporate does is always met with a grain of salt, right? So it's like, oh, here's corporate. And they have not done something like this before. And word gets out like, oh, that's going to cost a pretty penny. And they're all counting. And it's how they're rewarded and all that stuff. It all plays into this. So I think the one-on-one interviews, getting people on board, I prefer to do it one-on-one rather than in, obviously, during executive council meetings. You present the stuff, but I've learned that I do this, a divide and conquer, because there's a different kind of group dynamics when you have the executive team together or the board together than when you have them one-on-one. So that one-on-one reaching out, and the same thing we talked about with the compact merger, those workshops where it's doing the dirty work. It's down and dirty, talking to people, getting them involved, answering their objections and their questions. So we marched forward. And the first phase of all this was easy, right? It's the brand launch piece, right? And we talked about this a bit before. So we had a leadership summit where we brought in all the leaders from all the companies, the countries, and the facilities to understand what we were doing. So the big thing in branding is internal before external. So you always have to launch it internally before you launch it externally. And then we also had a public launch externally. So that was in early 2015, where we launched, we announced, like I said, new company, a name, identity, a new mission, call to action, a company website was part of it. All the things that people come to think of when they think of a rebranding initiative. So that was, I want to say, the easy part. I mean, that's the sizzly part. The stock price went up. People, investors were calling. People were excited about the new flex and what we were doing. They liked our message. It resonated well. But then the hard work starts, right? And usually when branding initiatives are funded, they fund them for that brand launch thing. So they might say, here's $1 million or $5 million or $10 million, or whatever it is, to do the videos, to rebrand the customer experience center, the front lobby. All those things are kind of centrally funded. But once that's done, they expect all the rebranding, the facilities, the sites, the lobbies in those 100 different locations in 30 countries, the language, the translations, the web and email domains, the legal company registrations, all that stuff needs to be done at the local level. And there is no central budget. The question we always ask, is there central budget to cover all this? No, you're going to have to work with your facilities and real estate people to implement these changes. So that's another big rub that people, and that's with every company I've ever worked with. They've never had a brand budget for activation. They always have it for brand launch. But when it comes to activation, it has to be self-funded. So you have to put guidelines in place, the migration strategies and all that. So
talk more about this and the notion of there being an activation budget, and because you didn't have it had to be self-funded. So what does that mean? Because couldn't those facilities or those areas say, well, if we don't have central budget, it's not coming out of my P&L. So how did you get through that?
Very good question, because they could say, I'm not doing it. I'm not going to take it out of my budget. Well, they were told that they had an 18-month migration path, and we provided all the tools and resources. So they had 100 facilities, but can you imagine, of those 100 facilities, there's probably 3 lobbies, an employee entrance and 2 customer entrances. I'm making that up. But you know, you're talking quickly, 300 lobbies throughout the world. And so actually, I worked with outside designers and stuff to come up with lobby designs. If it's a small lobby, medium lobby, large lobby, this is what your lobby should look like. And then spec'd out all the materials. We gave them a mandate. We gave them a roadmap and the tools. And then the largest facilities were asked to migrate first. So we had a prioritized list. So these would be done in 6 months. These would be done in 12 months. These would be done in 18 months. The ones that didn't see many customers, They could take 24 months, 36 months to rebrand, but they were expected to budget it out of their current, to work with their real estate. And there's several budgets at the local level. There's a real estate operations budget, and there's a P&L budget. So they had to work with them. But that was the tools and resources. You know, it's a lot of work for the brand team to have to keep track of all that. And signage, not only internal signage, but external signage. You change a logo or color, anything like that, everything's got to change. The way the street sign looks. And then we had to build what those monuments look like. This is the hard work. This is not the part that people think of when they think of branding or rebranding. They think of the launch part. And then it's like, and this is what a lot of agencies do, right? They do the front part, and then the hard work is left to the marketing team. And if there's not a strong marketing team or not a strong buy-in from the marketing or leadership team or local teams, then nothing happens.
But, and that's the activation implementation part of the tangible stuff. But there's also then the hard part of the embedding the brand just in to drive actual change through the people. So talk a bit about that part of it. How do you sustain the brand post-launch through the people aspect of it, whether it be really wanting to maintain a sense of consistency and still keeping the brand fresh with marketing design, but also ensuring that it, our brand is delivered through the brand in your case, and be with, as is the case, a lot of B2B is delivered through people, the people having the conversations and the customer relationships. And even from an employer brand standpoint, when you think about HR, talk a bit about that piece.
So that's kind of the brand experience, the three phases: brand launch, brand activation, and then brand experience. How do you embed it? And I think a lot of that, again, is providing the enabling tools, the guidance and the enabling tools. You're not providing the funding, but you are rolling up your sleeves. And we had calls from the call center. Well, how do I change my scripts when I answer the phone? It's like, wow, I didn't think of that. And so what are your scripts look like now? And how do we help you tweak them to change? So that's really where they start internalizing the new brand message and the new brand story into their day-to-day work. So I think it's, again, we had a central hub where we posted all this stuff, but then worked with each of these country leaders locally to provide, whether it's revised battle cards. Obviously, the marketing collateral piece is what people think of. All the collateral needs to change, which is true. But it's scripts. It's the day-to-day stuff. It's in the break room. With some of these break rooms, they had safety and compliance rules, and they were in like 10 different languages because they had employees from all these different countries. And so we had to come up with what these posters could look like and what the imagery and how to revamp those. And here you can download these and print them locally. So just a lot of thinking through all the, you mentioned earlier, a big Gantt chart, thinking through all the things that you need to come up with. It really takes an army of people to do this stuff. Instead of mandates, I'd like to say unleash and enable. That's really the role of brand today, is unleashing and enabling the brand. But to do that, you have to provide a lot of the tools and the templates to do so. And listen, and have a way for them to call, who to call. And we didn't have them all call. It's like, don't call Angelina. No, I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to field all these calls. But we had set up a system that your point of contact is so-and-so, they could sort through, and then we would meet and they would bubble it up, and then we would prioritize. And then we'd come up with our migration plan.
One of the stories I really like that we talked about before is one of the learnings that you brought over from HP was the brand portal, and not just the fact that you had a brand center and a brand portal, because obviously that's critical as part of the process, but even just some of the small details around what you chose to call it and the use of words and terminology. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so that gets us into the whole thing about the word branding in itself and how it can be met with skepticism or suspect, that type of thing. So we called it the communications hub or the one voice. So at HP, we ended up calling it one voice, the hub. Instead of calling it the HP brand portal, we called it the operation one voice. And it's like, oh, okay, people can get around the fact that we have to speak with one voice. We're speaking with disparate voices. And there's a lot of advantages to speaking with one voice around the world. And that will benefit them personally, as well as their company or their country. So that's what we did at HP. And the same thing, I would avoid calling anything brand and just call it. It could be the storytelling hub. If you want to lead with stories, or it could be our story. You could just call it our story and have all the tools there. You know, whatever you want to call it. But I think once you start calling it a brand hub, people's radar goes up.
One of the things that then always spend a lot of time talking about, especially in the B2B world, is this question of measurement. All right, sometimes you have that conversation even to make the case for the rebrand before, right? Because oftentimes you should be thinking about measurement in advance. So sometimes we can at least have a baseline to compare against. But talk a bit about this, how you think about successful measurement in a brand initiative, especially when you're going in and talking to a C-suite, because the measures that we typically have, if we just look narrowly in the world of brand, and you go talk about brand equity metrics, you go and talk to a CEO or a CFO and you say brand equity and their eyes will immediately glaze over and you'll likely lose credibility because it's not something of tangible value. We've forced them to have to learn our language. So talk about how you've done that successfully.
Yeah, you hit it right on the head. I think marketers in general, and most professions, marketing's not alone, but we have our own black box metrics that we get enamored with, and brand equity, brand identity, brand strength, brand continuity, brand all those things, brand experience. And then you're right, the CEO's eyes glaze over and they say, okay, we've got to focus on metrics that matter, I call it. And the metrics that matter are growth, right? So all CEOs are brought in to grow the company for the most part. And that's top line revenue, bottom line profits, and share price. Those are the three metrics that really matter. And so it's hard because you want to talk about your load on your website. You want to talk about your marketing qualified leads. You want to talk about brand equity tracking, brand love. We even called it, one person at HP called it brand love. And I thought, oh my God, that's not going to go over very well. You know, she's talking about how much brand love our customers have. It's like, okay. And I get it as branding people. I get it. And certainly if you're the web team, you need to know what the load time is of your website. If you're a social media manager, you need to know how many likes and followers and retweets you're getting. Those are important metrics. If you're a demand gen person, you need to know about marketing qualified leads and Salesforce.com and all that. But does the CEO need to know those metrics? No. And you will get so much more credibility if you lead as a business professional and you talk about metrics that matter. That matter to the CEO, that matter, and the language of business, as we all know, is accounting. I hate to say it, but that's the language that everybody measures. So it's revenue, top line revenue, share price, which we can affect through positive perceptions, and it's revenue and profit. And there's metrics that we can do that focus on that. So instead of talking about internal customer satisfaction, like 80% of our clients are happy with marketing support, or our countries are happy with the support marketing is providing, you're better off joining forces with the sales leader and saying, what is our share of wallet with these top 20 or top 100 customers quarter to quarter? Now, it's difficult because people like to talk, marketing likes to own metrics, like, and feel like they own them. And so we're really shifting from owned metrics to shared metrics, where we help. Is share of wallet just the marketing or branding person's purview? No. But if we can work with them to say we are increasing share of wallet with these top 20 accounts, and we did so successfully through a successful ABM program, through the content, through our demand gen programs, through our website, whatever it could be, the videos, the customized videos we've done, you're going to get a lot more traction, a lot more respect from the management team, in my opinion.
How have you been able to find some connection or this notion of a contribution when it comes to the share price?
Well, share price is, I like share price because, and again, you know, who really owns share price? You know, the CEO feels good, the chairman feels good, the head of investor relations feels good, but so should the branding and marketing person feel good. It should be a joint high five from everyone. And it's really based, what's share price based on? It's a perception of future success. It's about how much, it's perception. And what's perception? Marketing, it's branding, it's communications. If we can tell a great story about our leaders and our vision of where we're going, that's marketing's role, right? And we can help shape that. So who better to shape that? Now, we can't say we were responsible for increasing the share price $100 over 6 months, but we can certainly share that metric, and then point to the fact that other people contributed to that as well. So I love the share price one because that's about confidence and it's about perception and it's about leadership, management, future direction, and results too. But I love that one. And then top line revenue, you can show that, the share of wallet that I mentioned, but also how much revenue you're bringing in. If you can, again, a shared metric with you in sales. And then we should be talking, if we talk about profit, how effective and efficient is our marketing spend? So we should be talking about return on marketing investment, our people to program ratio. I mean, those are things that are tangible and measurable. And I find that that language works much better with the CEO and the C-suite than talking about brand equity or brand love.
A lot of time, even with some of those, you talked about people to program ratio. A lot of times we get asked for benchmarks, right? So that we have a comparison point. For most of us that aren't in the consumer world where you have Nielsen data and all these aggregate sources of data, how do you sort of benchmark if you're in these, like I said, the industries that don't have as clear third-party benchmarks?
Yeah, you're right. There's data out there that you can get for B2B and B2C and industry. You can do some little back of the envelope based on what you can find out about your competitors. If you know what they're investing in marketing or sales and how many employees they have roughly in those functions, you can kind of, like I said, back of the envelope calculations. If you don't, you can do a benchmark of where you are currently. And a lot of companies are currently at 50-50, you know, 50% people, 50% program dollars. So say you don't know what the benchmark, you know it should improve. You know you should get more out of your marketing spend than you are today. So if you can move from 50-50 to 40-60 to 30-70 to 20-80 over time, as long as you're showing improvement, I think a CEO would understand that as well, that you're getting more efficient with your marketing spend. Or you can do it based on revenue per marketing head. If you say, that's another way of doing it. Instead of counting things, like we did 32 trade shows this year, instead of outputs, we have to talk about outcomes. And we have to be business leaders, first and foremost, that have a specialty in marketing and branding, but we're business leaders first and foremost.
Yeah. I love the takeaway in this measurement piece, which is lean into the, it's better to take partial credit into a shared metric that has credibility than to own something that has you out on an island.
Totally, totally. You said it much more succinctly than I could.
As you think so 7-8 years on now from that brand work, as you look back, and even though you're not at Flex anymore, I'm sure you still take a peek every so often. How do you sort of look back on it now with that longer timeline and judge the sort of impact? How do you know that work has endured?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So I do a peek at their website. I just looked at it a couple of days ago to see. And the gratifying piece is that they still use a lot of the videos, the imagery, we did some beautiful graphics, taxonomy, iconography. That's the front end, the visual part. That still endures. So they have kept that. They have gone through a CEO change. And so I think that has changed their outlook. Some of their language is still the same. It's not exactly what it was. So they've done a website refresh, but I think the essence of being more than a Tronics company and being more inclusive and being out from behind the shadows, they're still keeping up with some of the thought leadership, which is excellent to see because that was one of the recommendations to have more of something to say and say it succinctly and own a category. So I think that has all been very gratifying, but it's going to morph and change over time.
But it's that storytelling, I think, that I think you're most proud of, right? And the sketch to scale story that really connects to the business impact and something that started to stick in, that became part of the internal vernacular and then translated itself to customers as well.
Yeah. I ran into a person the other day. It was so funny because in the past, anyway, I said that I used to work at Flextronics. We renamed Flex. They, oh, I know all about them. They said, oh, they're a big player here. And it was like, wow, that's pretty amazing. In the 10 years ago, people would say, who's Flextronics? Who's Flex? And so that was gratifying. So I think they're a little bit from behind the shadows and a little bit more out front, which is great. The storytelling.
When you think about some of the aspects that drove, that helped that rebrand be successful, if you were sat in front of a group of brand leaders who are working for B2B or these other corporate brands, and they knew there was a reason, rationale for a rebrand. What are some of the factors or criteria that set you up for success that you would suggest other people look at internally to almost as a predictive way to say, this increases our likelihood of success on the back end if we have some of these things, and vice versa, some things that are watch outs that you might need to mitigate for upfront?
Yeah. So I think we touched upon some of them. One is get the buy-in from the executive team, but not just the executive team, but from the local leaders. I think that's an important piece, because the local leaders is where they could sabotage you very easily, saying, well, that's corporate, that's US, that doesn't work in France, or that doesn't work in India. Very, very easy. And they won't find us. Very, very easy to do. The second is to make sure that you are not the brand cop, but you are the brand enabler, because nobody wants to run things by corporate. And quite frankly, no one in corporate has time to review everything. So what you need to do is the hard work. You have to provide all the tools and resources for them to do it yourself type DIY type environment, and have it in a place that is readily accessible and downloadable, and one place, because every place I've ever worked has had multiple brand portals or content portals. And the big thing is bring it all together into one place, because otherwise you have these pockets and, oh, I was using something from this portal. So shut all those down, make one portal everybody agrees to. And that's another reason why you don't call it a brand portal. You call it something different. So that's the big thing. You know, have one source of the truth, one source of the information. And everything should be, this is a small little thing, but make sure that everything has a schema, so to speak, where you're dating it, so people know what version of things you're talking about. Version control, I guess is what I'm talking. You'll never find, they'll say, well, this is what I found. What's the matter with this document? Oh, I didn't know this was out of date. Well, this way you can, like I said, one version of the truth, one portal of the truth, one portal for the story. And then you have a list of everything and what everything else goes. So that's a big thing. And then really have some fun with it. Make sure that people can see themselves, make it up close and personal, I think it is the other thing. Make it some, and celebrate local successes. There's nothing better than when you said, wow, we got this idea from our contact in Germany, and we thought it was brilliant the way they implemented it in their lobby redesign. Look at this. I'm sharing this with the rest of you, and have that on the portal too, so that you can share successes. And if you want to find out more, go talk to Hans in Germany. He'll tell you more of how he did that. And people say, wow, that's a beautiful lobby redesign, because we just gave them the tools and the resources and the suggestions, the schematics, but how they implement it can be very different. So share, make them the local heroes. Our job is really behind the scenes, behind the camera, not front and center.
And how much did it help you think that you had quite a charismatic marketing leader as well? How much of a role did that play?
Oh, absolutely. It certainly helps. Yeah. If you have someone who's out there and passionate and can paint a vision, I think that's beautiful. And a lot of times if the CEO can't, because they're hired for different skill sets, right? They have a different technical competency. The CMO can step in and be that charismatic leader. So I think that's an important piece, someone that they can believe and buy into. So it's very unusual to have the CEO be that charismatic leader, but it could happen. Like Elon Musk has proven to be that leader and doesn't need a marketing department, so to speak. So he says.
How do we any advice for sort of mitigating against some of this potential downside? You talk about the saboteur. I've always talked about it through lenses. There's always a silent assassin. And the problem about it being a silent assassin, you don't know, is they're silent. You don't know where they're going to come from.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you make them less silent, or you find out who they are, and some intelligence will tell you so-and-so is not on board. Somebody will usually give you a heads up. And then try to make them a hero. I think that's the biggest thing. If you make them feel like it was their idea, it's amazing how much further it'll go. There are natural leaders within a company that you need to tap into that have big influence on big swaths of employees. So it's a lot of word of mouth stuff. But yeah, the silent assassins are tough, because you say, where did that person come from? So hopefully you've identified, and go visit the countries, right? Go visit these people. And see for yourself and talk to the local people. Have a little coffee talk, understand people on board. Are you feeling good about this? Or is there anything that's troubling or stopping you from implementing? And you'll learn a lot.
What did you find that that did? So by going in person and visiting people, what do you see as the outcome of that?
Well, I think it disarms people. I brought lots of thumb drives because I said, here, because not everybody goes to the brand portal and downloads. It's like another step. How easy it is, obviously, but it's like, here, can we put this on your computer? Let's download all these templates now. And they go, oh. So I'm actually forcing the next step. So that's big. Bring the tools and resources, show them, sit down with them, and then ask them, again, what's standing in the way? What else would you like us to work on? These are the things we've worked on. The call center scripts was one that we uncovered. I don't have a resource to do this. Okay, we'll assign someone to rewrite all these in the tone and language and the voice that you need.
So that it's interesting, especially now in the sort of remote hybrid role, we forget about that importance of that one-to-one connection, of that relationship building that happens, and how much of an important part of the job that is.
So important. I remember during, this was an HP day, again, example, I had assigned, I went to the leaders, I asked them to assign an empowered person that could work with me on another transition. So that we all met in person, we made some great decisions. I highlighted them, I summarized them, sent out meeting notes. And this one woman who I knew was determined to make this not work, she said, well, I wasn't there. She said, I never agreed to that. And I said, but wait, you sent Alice as your representative. But I wasn't there. And I said, no, you assigned, so I really made a point of it because this was fully empowered people who can make decisions on the behalf of your, if you can't be there in person. So you'll get those people that play those games and say, well, I didn't agree to that. Always going to find that. And then there's a saying, hug them harder. No matter how hard it is, it's like, okay, these are the troublemakers. You got to pinch myself and say, okay, hug them harder, make them the hero. How can I make them the hero in all this? And somehow it melts away.
That's a great motto. I hadn't heard that one before.
Hug them harder.
And Janine, thank you for sharing that. So many rich and practical and I think more than anything, timeless learnings from that rebrand. I think it shows that so many things when you go through a rebrand or about this job that you only truly learn from having gone through an experience. And a lot of these learnings are just things that you can't pick up in a text box. So it's right in the textbook. So helpful to hear those real world stories. Wanted to end just with a few questions about you. Maybe talk a little bit about what are you up to today? What gets you excited today? Have you translated all this experience into what you're doing?
Yeah, I actually did. So after I left HP, I found that I worked on a lot of transformations. I was always called to do transformations. It was kind of strange, and it became my core competency a little bit, like, oh, we need to transform the marketing, this, that process, whatever. We need to transform sustainability. Angelina can do it. And it was kind of interesting because I never thought of myself as transformation change. Anyway, long story short, after I left, I said, I'm going to write down, because you live all this stuff, Gabriel, like you said, you're living it day to day and you're learning, but until you kind of step back and make some sense of it all. So I actually put it all together in a book. So I wrote a book about 4 years ago called Marketing Flexology. And it's no reflection on Flextronics, but it's Flexology because it's really how to outsmart change and future-proof your career. So it was really about building a marketing organization that can pivot with change and with transition, with disruption. I had seen so many management changes and had so many different roles over a very long career. And so I captured that. So that was one way that excites me. And I've been thinking about a sequel to that called Brand Flexology, because I do think everyone needs to rebrand or to at least keep their brand fresh in the new age. And so a lot of the same principles, be able to take insight and agility, right? Take customer insight and be more agile in implementing it. Then it's not about art and science. It's not about brand and demand. It's about insight and agility. So those are kind of the cornerstones. So that keeps me excited. I like to keep current, and I'm a lifelong marketer, and I like to call myself a student and teacher of marketing and career agility. So I like anything like that is very fascinating. I do meetups. There's a lot of meetups now on AI, learning the new AI tools. I'm just fascinated by it. Not that I've figured it out yet, but just to understand what's out there. So those kind of things. Listen to podcasts like yours and the rich information you share with readers and listeners, I should say. So
Well, thank you for the contribution through your book and your insights. And as you get further into the brand version of it, we'd love to have you back on.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Gabe.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Angeline.
Thank you so much. I appreciate everything you do.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.